I'm just sitting here feeling the silence of the community. Feeling that as very much a support. The topic tonight is refuge in Sangha. Perhaps the classic definition of Sangha is a community of monks and nuns, the ordained Sangha. And that expands to include the community of practitioners who, lay practitioners who also practice the Buddhist teaching. The monastic order in particular has had a really large role in preserving and transmitting the Dharma, the teachings, for 2,600 years. That preservation of the monastic order and the transmission of the teachings through the oral transmission in the first several hundred years and It is how we are here today. The fact of that transmission through the lineage of beings, primarily through the monastic Sangha, is how we have heard the teachings. And so, in a very real sense, that community of the monastic Sangha has been a support for us, is a support for our practice. And yet, in terms of refuge, the understanding is that the monastic Sangha itself is not the refuge, but rather, as Bhikkhu Bodhi puts it, the Sangha that serves as refuge is not an institutional body, but an unchartered spiritual community comprising all those who have achieved penetration of the innermost meaning of the Buddhist teaching. So those who have understood the teachings for themselves. Or perhaps we can say, have made themselves a refuge. That language that that Gil used last night, that we make ourselves a refuge. So going for refuge to the Sangha . It's not about the personalities of people. At one point, I was in a group that was having a conversation with Ajahn Sumedho about this question of refuge and Sangha, and he said something like, I don't know if this is an exact quote, but something like, Take refuge in the personalities of the Sangha? I don't think so. We take refuge in the intention and the commitment towards the practice and understanding of the teachings, the intentions towards love, compassion, wisdom, ethics. We take refuge in the capacity of those beings, the true refuge that Bhikkhu Bodhi described, those who have penetrated the innermost teachings of the Buddha. Those beings are the ones that have the capacity to guide us and support us in our practice. And this is where we take refuge, is in that that capacity, and in, I see, as in the intention, in our communities, the communities that we have, our lay communities, we can, as in a way, consider those communities a refuge too, because we share that intention, we share that that deep commitment to practice, even if we aren't at that point of being an actual refuge. Shared, we have a community with shared values for awakening. And I remind myself of this sometimes if I'm having something or an issue with somebody, a little bit of a place where there's a little bit of a disagreement or a conflict between ideas of how things should happen. I just remind myself, we have shared intentions. I want to just connect back to that, the shared intention towards freedom. And that for me helps to shift the energy so that there can be an easier communication. And so we can step back into that intention for our communities. And perhaps remind each other of those intentions at times. We do this at our board meetings at IMC. We sit around in the circle at the board meetings, at the beginning of all of our board meetings, and we start every meeting with a reading, an inspiring reading, to remind us of our intention, and then a sitting. So supporting each other in this way in our communities to remind ourselves of these intentions. This is a way in which we can take refuge in the Sangha, go for refuge in the Sangha. We become supports for each other. But primarily tonight, I'd like to explore this idea of becoming a refuge, because it seems to me that that's kind of the other side of the refuge of Sangha, that it's individuals that follow the teachings of the Buddha, that understand the teachings, that understand the Dharma, that become the Sangha, that become the refuge. And so that's a worthy aspiration, to become a refuge. Some quotes from the suttas. One should discard all fetters and make a refuge for oneself. The fetters being those forces that bind us. The fetters, the forces that keep us clinging. Discard all fetters, discard all attachments, and make a refuge for oneself. Dwell with yourselves as an island, with yourselves as a refuge, with no other refuge. With the Dhamma as an island, with the Dhamma as a refuge, with no other refuge. And this has an implication of making a refuge for yourself, making yourself a refuge. I think this passage is interesting from a couple different perspectives. One is that the repeated parallel, dwell with yourselves as an island, with yourselves as a refuge, with no other refuge. Dwell with the Dhamma as an island, with the Dhamma as a refuge, with no other refuge. That phrase, with no other refuge, to me points to the way that oneself as a refuge and the Dhamma as a refuge are the same thing. When the Dhamma is the refuge, when the Dhamma has been made the refuge in us. There's a kind of an independence, a self-reliance. And that's the other piece I find interesting in this passage, this pointing to self-reliance, pointing to this capacity to engage, the strength that Gil was pointing to the other day, the strength of heart, the strength of mind. It's not a wimpy thing to be a refuge. It's a great strength in that. And so becoming a refuge, becoming independent in the Dhamma, going back to Bhikkhu Bodhi's, connecting with, understanding the innermost teaching of the Dhamma. We do the inner work. We have to do the inner work. We explore what we've been exploring this week. The understanding of our own minds. Through the cultivation of this capacity of being aware with a perspective of wisdom. This is our work. And that creates the conditions, as we've been speaking about, creates the conditions for that understanding to happen. And so we explore understanding our own minds. We have a sense, we get a sense very deeply of our humanness. That to me is one of the beautiful things about this practice of turning and looking inward. It's like through looking inward, we see reflected all of humanity. And that offers some humility and compassion for the way the world is. And also as we explore this, human terrain of our hearts and minds, we start to be able to respond more wisely to our own experience and to the world in general. And so it's a great support, this becoming our own, going inwards to this understanding, making a refuge of ourselves for ourselves. Make a refuge for oneself is that first quote. Creates the possibility that we can become a refuge for others. Another quote, which actually doesn't use the word saranang for refuge, but Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as refuge. Make yourself a refuge for all beings. The word that he's translating as refuge there is kema, the word for security or safety. Make yourself a safe place for all beings. And so it's not a selfish act, this act of turning inwards and understanding our own hearts and minds. It's not a selfish act, this retreating from the world to come here to understand our hearts and minds. It's not a selfish act. It gives us the strength to become more effective in the world. I think too we become a refuge by walking this path. Gil was exploring the analogy of the path last night in the simile that he gave, the person that discovered the ancient path and cleared the path and found this city. And then the understanding of that path being the Eightfold Path. I like the path analogy. I think about paths. Paths in the woods. A path through the woods is worn by many people walking there. And so the activity of walking on the path clears it for those coming behind us, creates the conditions to make it easier for someone to follow us. And as Gil described last night, the path, the Eightfold Path, the description of somebody who is awakened, who is free, who is a refuge, is someone who is living the Eightfold Path, for whom it is not something they have to think about or practice, but it's just the natural expression of their being. And so people who are free, awakened, are still cultivating the path for us. They're still walking the path, demonstrating it, modeling it, making it available for us to follow. And even when we are walking on the path, we are creating the conditions to make it easier for others to follow. There's another teaching that reflects this same understanding of the path, actually the path and the goal not being so separate. And that's what this is saying really to me, that the path that we walk to become free is the path that we live when we are free. That's what we live when we're free, so that there's not such a separation between path and goal. And we can think about potentially modeling the behavior of those we admire, those who have that understanding, modeling that behavior as part of our journey. There's a teaching called the Atakavaga, and Gil recently has a book published, a new translation of this text. I'm not reading from his translation because I didn't have a copy of his book with me, but if you're interested in this flavor that I'm offering here, you can check it out in his book called The Buddha Before Buddhism. And this poem, this collection of poems, or this text, it's basically, it's 16 poems that are kind of they're odes to non-clinging. They're beautiful expressions of non-clinging, and they describe. There's some of the poems describe a person who's caught in clinging, so an ordinary person. Some of the poems describe that kind of a person. Some of the poems describe somebody who's free, who has transcended clinging. And then some of the poems describe how one might move from being caught to being free. So it describes the path of practice to become free. Something that I particularly love about this text is that the description of somebody who is awakened is described in very almost ordinary language, ordinary ways, very this-worldly ways. They're described by how they are, how they engage in the world very much. A lot of the descriptions are about how they function. So I'll read some of this, these verses describing someone who's free. And these poems often are in dialogue, and so somebody asks the Buddha a question, and the Buddha responds. And so the questioner in this poem says, "Having what vision, being of what character, is one called peaceful? Tell me about the Supreme Person." And the Buddha responds, and I'm just reading excerpts here. "A person who is not angered, not frightened, not boastful, not fretful, who gives wise advice, who is calm, restrained in speech, who is indeed a sage. A person who does not attach to the future, who does not sorrow over the past, who finds solitude amidst sense contact, and is not guided by fixed views. A person who is retiring, not deceitful, not covetous, not greedy, not impudent, not arousing contempt, who does not engage in malicious speech. A person who does not relish pleasure, who is not arrogant, who is mild and of ready wit, who is not credulous, who by nothing is repelled. A person who does not take on the training in hopes of material gain, who is unperturbed if they get nothing, who is not hampered by wishes and not greedy for flavors. A person who is even-tempered, ever attentive, who does not suppose that in this world they are equal, superior, or inferior, who is free of conceit. A person for whom there are no tethers, who in knowing truth is not tethered in any way, and in whom no wishes are found for existence or non-existence. This is someone I call peaceful. They are indifferent to sensual pleasure. In them bonds are not found. They have overcome attachment. The sage, free of greed and selfishness. The sage regards nothing in the world as one's own and does not grieve because of what does not exist. Not blindly following religious teachings, such a one is truly called peaceful." So that's a description of someone who is free. And the description of the path of practice, basically, and I'll read a section here, but basically to me, what it sounds like is, instead of it saying, one is not boastful, not frightened, one is even-tempered, it points to striving towards that, being, should be, should explore that, should train with that. And so the questioner asks, "Tell me about the path of practice." And the Buddha responds, "A person should not have covetous eyes. One should close one's ears to ordinary chatter. One should not be greedy for flavors. One should not cherish anything in the world. One should be meditative, not footloose. One should desist from worry. One should not be indolent. One should live in lodgings where there is little noise. One should not fear blame, nor be conceited when praised. One should drive out greed, selfishness, anger, and malicious speech. One should not be a boaster, not speak scheming words. One should not cultivate impudence, nor utter quarrelsome speech. One should not be drawn into telling lies, nor be deliberately treacherous. One should not despise others for their way of life or wisdom or precepts and practices. If ascetics or ordinary people irritate one with their talkativeness, one should not respond harshly, for the peaceful do not retaliate. Knowing the Buddha's teaching, an ever-attentive person who investigates it should train in it. Knowing the cooling of desire as peace, one should not be negligent in applying Gautama's teaching. With regards to the Blessed One's teaching, one who is diligent should constantly venerate it by following his example. That, to me, that last sentence really points to the kind of the crux of the exploration here, follow the example. And so again, we follow the path by modeling the path. To take a line from here, if you want to be peaceful, act peacefully. Now, this practice to me, not necessarily a simple one, because it is not about repressing non-peace in acting peacefully. In my own exploration of this kind of a teaching, what I find very powerful is the challenge of it, is the exploration of how do I model this while fully understanding the mind is impatient right now. How do I model patience but fully acknowledge when patience is happening? This is it's an interesting exploration to play with, feeling the impatience arise. We may see our bodies react in kind of quick movements or sharp actions or harsh or clipped speech. And how might it be possible to fully acknowledge, yes, there's impatience in here, but see if I can behave in a way that does not leak out of into the environment. When I've explored this kind of practice, it's quite amazing how transformative that intention is, because it's basically a practice of intention. Connecting to the intention for peacefulness, the intention towards patience, even as one feels impatience. And in that connection to the intention, it has, and the following through on that intention in terms of behavior, it has a rebound effect on the mind. And it can be quite surprising, if you really fully engage with that, how you might find a state of impatience just withering as you explore this. And so to me, this is a kind of an inspirational approach to the Eightfold Path. It's not just a set of practices, but really a description of how a noble life is lived. And also last night, Gil mentioned the Dharma as being a force in our society. It's not just an inner force for transformation internally. It can be a force in our society, in our culture. We can see in our culture how greed, aversion, and delusion are contagious. But so too are peace, love, wisdom, generosity, kindness, compassion, also contagious. So walking the path may create the conditions for people to follow. Just again, think about the path analogy. If you're walking in the woods and you see a little path maybe following off, it's like, ooh, where does that go? The existence of the path can create interest in following the path. And so we can become this force in our society. And so, very much we are asked to practice in the world. How do we bring these practices in the world? And this is a question that feels especially poignant in this country at this time, to me, to many of us, to many of those of you I've spoken to many people I'm speaking to, other Dharma practitioners. How do we meet this? Such energy of delusion, greed, aversion that is seemingly very obviously rampant. It's always been rampant. It has always been rampant, but it seems to be on special display right now, at least in our country, particularly on special display. And I think something I've been finding interesting to reflect on and explore is how the patterns that are at work in our minds, patterns that happen in our minds, are the same kinds of patterns at work in culture often. The patterns in our culture are often just a kind of an elaboration on the patterns at work in our minds. And so understanding how our own minds work, we can carry that understanding somewhat into what's happening in the large, in our culture. And so for example, we have thoughts arise in our mind. A thought may arise about something that happened in the past, or an idea about something that might happen in the future, an idea about person who maybe we think might do something to us. I had this once. I was in a relationship at one point, and my mind had this habit of projecting things that that person might do and that I wouldn't like. And then I'd get angry. Those thoughts were, you know, they had no bearing on reality. Well, I mean, the way my mind said this was like, well, it's like something that person would do. So, you know, it there was a belief in it. There was an investment in that story to some extent. And so there's thoughts that arise in the mind and an investment or a belief in them in some fashion. And those thoughts have an impact on us. They have a real impact. Anger arose in my mind. That has a real impact on the body. It has a physical impact. Pressure, heat, tightness, tension, contraction. A thought arises in the mind. It doesn't matter if the thought is true or not. It has a real physical, it can have a real physical impact. Seemingly, the more the belief is, the stronger the impact. Whether or not the thought is true, believing seems to be a key piece of that impact. In our world, fake news is in the news these days. And the recent story in particular about the man who went to the pizzeria, I guess in Washington, D.C., having read the story of fake news about there being children held captive there, some scheme of pedophilia or something that the story was about. I never read the fake news story, but so this person believed that story. It was fake news. Somebody knew it was fake. Somebody created it as fake. But this other person read it and believed it. And based on that belief, went to take action, took a gun to the pizzeria, and was going to liberate the children. There were no children in the pizzeria. This is a completely made-up story. And the person fired the gun in the pizzeria. Fortunately, nobody was injured. And yet this fake news has real-world impact. Very similar display. In one case, the thoughts arising in our own minds are coming based on what's conditions from the outside and inside. In this case, the fake news is kind of external. And then somebody picks that up and acts on it. So the tools and practices of the Dharma, I think, that support us in meeting our inner struggles, in meeting our inner investigation of how how all suffering arises, the exploration of how our suffering is arising in our own experience, the tools that we bring to bear on that, I think, we can bring to bear on the suffering, the struggles in our society. And three tools I'd like to highlight here: wisdom, love, and ethics. And with so much hatred being expressed, love and compassion can both help our hearts meet that and offer an alternative. When we explore anger, hatred in our own hearts, the practice is one of allowing and not acting on. And so this kind of exploration of meeting hatred in the world How do we meet it? How do we meet hatred without closing down, without pushing it down in our own hearts and minds? In the Dhammapada, hatred never ceases through hatred. Through non-hatred alone does it end. And so love helps us to meet hatred. Compassion helps us to meet hatred. We understand, too, in our own hearts and minds, when there's anger and hatred arising in our own hearts and minds, often it's arising out of some form of suffering, some form of conflict internally. And so seeing it happen externally, maybe we can begin to understand the conflicts that are underneath it. Begin to open our hearts to that. The practice of ethics helps us to not act out of hatred. And the practice of wisdom helps us to counter ignorance and confusion that underlie that hatred. And so wisdom, just reflecting on wisdom a little bit as a practice, understanding the workings of our own minds, how they play, how the suffering is constructed, how things play out. We see these same patterns in the world. Another pattern, one that I kind of referred to a little bit the other day, confirmation bias. I talked about this a little bit in the the teaching on dependent origination, how we tend to search out information that confirms what we believe. We take in information that kind of orients with our habits and patterns, and we don't take in information that doesn't orient to that. We search out information that confirms what we already believe. Another way the Buddha put this teaching, what one frequently ponders, that becomes the inclination of the mind. And the inclination of the mind, we search out information that confirms that inclination. A philosopher 400 years ago also expressed this and saw this, Francis Bacon. He spoke about this, that we create biases based on our beliefs. And our beliefs are created based on our experience, our culture, our education, what we're taught, our society, our political leaders. So our beliefs are not separate from our culture. In fact, this is the one that Francis Bacon called this the idols of the cave. And if you're living in a cave with a bunch of people, you're going to share the same belief, share the same ideas, and then it becomes hard to break out of that. In the Kalama Sutta, the Buddha suggested that we not go based on what we believe, on what others say, on what our teacher says, because it agrees with our beliefs, because it seems rational, but to check it out, both in terms of what the wise say is helpful and in our own experience. How do we navigate what is true? How do we explore our beliefs? Check it out in our own experience. We have the tools to overcome this confirmational bias. One of the things to help overcome it is knowing about it. And this is what Francis Bacon was trying to do 400 years ago. He was writing this article for scientists saying, hey guys, you are, doing research that confirms what you believe because you're not looking for other things. So there are ways that we can consciously look at it. And one of the key pieces is, rather than always looking for whether to confirm what is true, confirm our beliefs, see if there's evidence for the other side. Check our sources. Remember that we carry perspectives, beliefs, and that they are beliefs, recognizing them as beliefs. I was doing some research on this confirmational bias, an article popped up about a pretty recent study that was looking at how to correct for this confirmational bias, the bias that we tend to read things, take things in based on what we believe. And in this study, they created a bias in a fake trial setting, created a bias about whether the person was guilty or not in these two groups of people. And so they created the bias of whether they thought the person was guilty or not guilty. And then they had something that they read. And when that thing that they read about more information about the person and what had happened, when they read that article, if that article was in an easy to read font, their biases were reinforced. If that article was in a hard to read font, they had to slow down to read it. It disrupted their biases. They had to think a little bit more. So slow down. It's another tool. I thought that was fascinating. Just that the font could impact and alter confirmational bias. And then I think it's so important to ground in ethics, especially as we act out of our beliefs. We carry beliefs with us, and we will act out of our beliefs. Some beliefs, of course, you know, there's different kinds of beliefs. And it's useful to begin to check into how grounded in reality are our beliefs. You know, there's just as a kind of a silly example, this came up as I was talking to a student one day. If you're walking across the desert, it's a belief that you need to carry water with you to survive getting across the desert. Very useful belief. Useful to act on that belief. You might also have a belief, if you've heard stories or somebody's been telling tall tales, that when you walk across this particular desert, that big birds will swoop out of the sky and carry you away. Different kind of belief. And so, you know, it's incumbent on us to check into our beliefs. How true are our beliefs? And when our beliefs are true, we especially need to be careful as we're acting on them. Because when our beliefs have more of a sense of grounding in what's right or what's ethical, a sense of self-righteousness can have us decide or believe, well, any action is, in a sense, that the means justify the ends. And so I want to point us all back to ethics in terms of, as we act out of our beliefs, and we will act out of our beliefs, ground yourself in ethics. In meeting injustice in the world, how to respond? How do we respond to injustice in the world? It's useful to have some equanimity. Not always possible, but interesting to explore that possibility. In my understanding, equanimity about what is happening in the world is not about agreeing with it, but it's about recognizing that conditions have created what is happening. It's about recognizing that it is happening. Equanimity doesn't use up energy fighting with the fact of what has already come to be. Instead, equanimity fully understands this is what has come to be. And yet equanimity is not passive, or does not create necessarily the conditions for passivity. Rather, I think it allows us to marshal our energy to respond skillfully. If we're spending our energy arguing with the past, trying to figure out how to change the past, we are not using our resources wisely to look at how to respond skillfully now. And so this, to me, is what it means to have equanimity in the face of injustice. It supports a wise response now, because we can see more clearly, and because our resources, our energy, is freed up to act. Our energy and our resources are not tied up in confusion and constriction. And this may mean, this can result then in compassionate action, actively opposing things that are unethical out of compassion. And again, grounding in ethics, it's not so helpful to oppose unethical conduct with unethical conduct. It just reinforces the pattern. to think that we're going to act unethically, or to think, well, you know, if I do this, you know, we have to kind of use their tools, these tools of greed, aversion, and delusion, to overcome greed, aversion, and delusion. It doesn't work. We see that in our own minds. Greed, aversion, and delusion applied to greed and aversion and delusion multiplies greed, aversion, and delusion. We may not be able to come to equanimity in acting in the world, but perhaps we can remember to ground in ethics, even if we are not fully balanced and we are angry. Can we ground in some ethics as a support for us in responding to the world? So we see in our own minds just how slow transformation is. How stubborn the habits and patterns are. And yet, we do keep going because of this confidence that we gain as we see in small ways how our patterns fall apart, how love, wisdom, and ethics serve us on our personal journey. The more we cultivate love and wisdom and ethics and mindfulness and concentration and gratitude and generosity and tranquility and equanimity and love, the more we cultivate those, the stronger they become and the more freedom there is. The habits and patterns of our society are equally, if not more, entrenched. And yet I kind of had this image of, you know, in our own minds, we have moments of mindfulness. And as Gil said, no moment of mindfulness is ever wasted. You know, they get lost, they get swamped, but they come back and we reconnect to that intention. The intention of wisdom and compassion and mindfulness in our own hearts and minds. And as I was reflecting about this, I was thinking that each of us as individuals are kind of like moments of mindfulness in our culture. That we can, I don't know if it really maps, but it's a nice thought that as individuals engaging in the world, that we may be like these little moments of mindfulness popping up in our own hearts and minds. Each person's love, compassion, wisdom, ethics, strengthening and creating the conditions for more of that in the world. And perhaps our Dharma communities, our sanghas, can be this refuge through opening the path, creating this path for others to find and walk, becoming a refuge. Our communities, our Dharma communities, becoming a refuge in this sense for the suffering of the world. Let's sit for a moment.